Skin Flints podcast, brought to you by Vetrus, the specialists in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy, in association with elearning.vet.
Hello and welcome to Skin Flint, the podcast where we discuss all things related to pet skin. Thank you very much for listening, whether you are a vet or vet nurse topping up on your CPD, or a pet owner looking to learn about more about skin disease. You are in the right place. And today we're going to be focusing on a specific breed and the breed choice of many, including Mr. Tony Robinson of Time Team and Baldrick off of Blackadder fame. And this is, of course, the West Highland White Terrier, or Westie. And it may not have escaped your attention, we've actually called today's podcast Westies and Besties as a nod to the publication Westies and Besties, which is a fantastic magazine devoted to the breed, which you can pick up at your local internet, because I don't think anyone goes to the shop anymore. And with me, as ever, is the producer of this podcast, the man behind elearning.vet, who doesn't have a Westie, and I guess I wouldn't describe him as a bestie, but I would certainly say you're more of a friend than just a producer. It's Mr. Paul Heesman.
That's very kind of you, John. I think I've heard worse introductions for me, so thank you. I'm in West Yorkshire, if that helps at all.
Yes, absolutely. It qualifies. So you're sort of a Westie.
And I'm a West Ham fan. So yeah, there you are. West Yorkshire and West Ham. I'm a Westie by heart.
I'm a West Ham fan as well. So that makes two Westies there then. And of course, my co-host, who complained about my intro last time, so I'm going to mix it up a little bit for this time, and say that this European leading dermatologist, when she isn't treating things like Westie skin disease, she can be found rambling the hills of the Lake District. And today, bringing you along one of her own besties to talk to, it is Dr. Sue Patterson.
Thank you, John. It almost sounded as if that introduction was planned. I'm really delighted we've got Dr. Janet Littlewood joining us today, who's a very long-standing friend, someone who actually was responsible for bringing me into the dermatology world, so to speak. She was my mentor when I was a resident many hundreds of years ago at the Animal Health Trust in Cambridge. So she's a good friend. She's a very experienced dermatologist. And so I'm really looking forward to our conversation with her, which, as you've already said, is going to be around one of the most common breeds we see as dermatologists, and probably one of the most challenging breeds we see as dermatologists, the beautiful West Highland White Terrier. So yeah, should be a good session today.
Brilliant. And so I'm guessing that you've both probably seen a fair few Westies or two in your time.
Oh, if I had a pound for every Westie that I'd seen, John, I wouldn't need to be working. So absolutely, no question about it.
Oh, brilliant. Well, let's not waste any time then and get on with our conversation then with Janet. So, yeah, let's bring Janet in.
So, hi, Janet. Thank you so much for joining us on the third of our Skin Flint podcast today. It's great that you've been able to come along and join us. And today we're going to tackle Westie skin disease, which I think as a dermatologist is something you see quite a lot of. One of the things that I think always interests me is people think that Westies are much more prone to skin disease. Do you think they are when you see them?
Well, hi, Sue, and thanks very much for inviting me along. Yes, I think that the perception that Westies are overrepresented with skin disease is actually true. But I think that Westie skin disease is not one distinct disorder, but I see a lot of Westies with allergic skin disease. And if you look at what's been published around the world, I think every review of itchy dogs and allergic dogs has the West Highland White Terrier as an overrepresented breed. So sadly, yes, they are frequently affected by skin disease.
I've got to ask this as well to you two as a not quite a dermatologist myself, but wondering, you know, kind of, if this is something that we see a lot, is there any correlation between the fact that West Highland White Terriers have like entirely white coats? And, you know, I've sort of heard that before, like, you know, there could be some correlation there.
Well, it's not only Westie owners or people with white coated dogs think that they're at risk. There is not actually any linkage with coat colour and allergic skin disease. There's certainly other breeds apart from Westies that are overrepresented, and you know, a lot of terriers are at risk of developing allergic skin disease, but so are the retriever group, and we see it in plenty of other breeds. I think, you know, overall allergic skin disease is a relatively common presentation, but within the Westie breed, I think the prevalence is higher than perhaps amongst some of the other breeds. But in none of the breeds is there any coat colour linkage demonstrated.
Okay, so that's interesting then. So with that in mind then, Janet, if I was an owner and I was thinking to myself, I quite like the idea of getting a Westie, but I'm listening to this podcast thinking, oh no, this sounds like bad news. Is there anything that I could do to reduce the risk of getting a Westie with a skin problem?
Well, as with getting any new puppy, you should be asking about health issues in the dam and the sire. Usually you'll be able to have sight of the mother of the litter of puppies. You should ask the breeder if there's any history of skin disease in her dog, in previous litters, any related animals. And then actually with a cautious eye, you can have a look at the mother herself. And one of the real telltale things with a white-coated allergic dog is that it does show up if they're licking themselves, because saliva causes staining on the hair coat. So any dog that is licking itself will get a change of hair coat colour. It'll go a sort of rusty, reddish-brown colour. So, you know, if the mother has got four brown feet instead of white feet, that would be highly suggestive that she might be allergic herself, and then at risk of producing puppies that would be at risk of developing allergy. It definitely runs in families, just as it does in human beings. But the development of disease in the offspring is not a simple inheritance. There are lots of other factors involved. And within one litter of dogs, or several litters from a dog that's maybe only mildly affected itself, you can get a range of presentations of normal puppies through to mildly affected puppies, but you can get severely affected puppies from parents who are themselves only very mildly affected. So, you know, ask some questions, have a look at the mother, and you know, try and be cautious. I think as dermatologists, it's very easy for us to get biased because we only see the ones that have got skin disease. So I'm sure there are lots of healthy Westies out there, but those are some of the things that I think it would be sensible to look out for.
And I think it's really interesting, Jan, when you were saying there about, you know, breeders and Westies and things. I think that's one of the strengths of the change in legislation we saw last year with Lucy's Law, the fact that people now should go to breeders to get dogs. They shouldn't be buying them from someone they meet in the car park of a local pub, where they shouldn't be, you know, meeting people with no history of what's going on. I think it's really important, as you say, that they know where they're getting it from, don't they?
Absolutely. And that also raises the question of, what about a rescue Westie? Should I be giving a home to a Westie that's been put up for adoption? And I would urge caution in that situation, because an awful lot of dogs get put up for rehoming because they have difficult to manage chronic skin diseases. And I mean, I happen to work fairly closely geographically to a rehoming facility, and lots of the dogs that are put up for rehoming when they're in those facilities are absolutely fine, because it's a very low allergen environment in their beautiful kennels. But they get rehomed into a domestic situation, and within days, you know, they can start to show signs of allergic skin disease again. So if you are looking at getting a rehomed animal, you need to check whether or not there's any history of skin disease previously, and what the reason is for rehoming. And I would steer well away from any dog that's been rehomed because it's got a skin problem, because, you know, if the first owners couldn't manage it, then it's going to be a difficult case to manage.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask that, Jen, actually. Yeah, it's like, what about... you know, if they're looking all right in the rescue centre, but that's so interesting.
They do. I mean, I fell foul of that one myself. I rehomed, it wasn't a Westie, it was a gorgeous little Jack Russell. But because of my experience with seeing animals that have been rehomed and within weeks being referred to me, I took this little dog home and I warned my children. I said, look, if this dog starts to itch and scratch, I'm afraid it's going back because mummy can't cope with an atopic dog. And this dog developed redness of its underside and its paws and its ear flaps within 24 hours of coming into my home.
Grief.
Yeah.
Such helpful advice, Janet. Thank you. And I should ask as well, while we're talking about disease, are we just talking when we talk about Westie skin disease? Is this just allergy that we're talking about? Because presumably there are other things.
Yeah, well, they can be potentially at risk from any skin disease. But what most people describe as or call Westie skin disease is actually allergic skin disease. But often, particularly with Westies, there's secondary infection involved. And the majority of the ones that I see are allergic to things in the environment rather than to food triggers. But, you know, clinically, those look exactly the same. And you have to rule out a food trigger before you can label it as an environmental reaction.
So, Janet, when we say Westie skin disease, you know, typically if you see pictures of these Westies, you know, they have this horrible black, thickened, smelly skin that's often what we refer to as Westie skin disease. And obviously part of that's allergy. But in your experience, what else contributes to that? What else is going on in those dogs?
Okay. A lot of these Westies have secondary infections, or as we're supposed to call it now, dysbiosis. And particularly, the Westies seem to be very prone to Malassezia overgrowth and develop Malassezia dermatitis, which in itself will promote the itch. And in my experience, Malassezia dermatitis, the itch associated with that is really quite difficult to control. It doesn't respond well to some of the therapies that we now have that are licensed for treating allergic dogs, like ocrelizumab and locovetmab, and even glucocorticoids don't have a huge impact on the itch associated with Malassezia dermatitis. So you have to identify the organisms that are involved on the skin surface in these greasy, smelly, often hyperpigmented Westies, and address it directly.
So I'm just going to backtrack a bit there. So you mentioned a word there that perhaps not all of our listeners would understand. What do you mean by dysbiosis?
Dysbiosis. Well, dysbiosis is the more acceptable term now for the situation where, instead of a diverse population of organisms on the skin surface of a healthy dog, you get an imbalance and a dramatic increase in numbers of maybe one or two particular organisms. And so you lose that diversity and you have effectively an overgrowth. And that is usually associated with an underlying change in the skin immune system, which allows this overgrowth of certain strains of organism, which we still call infection. And I think with clients, it's not inappropriate to still call it an infection, because they won't understand what the term dysbiosis means at all. But it's a change of balance from a normal, very diverse cutaneous flora into a flora that is dominated by one or two organisms at the expense of the rest of the flora on the skin surface.
So, I mean, in simple terms, we know that dogs who have allergies have an awful lot going on in their skin. We know that they have this different numbers of organisms on their skin, different numbers of bacteria, different numbers of yeast. We know that they have far less what we call richness of the bacteria on the skin. But we also know as well they have things like barrier function problems. So the skin barrier is very poor. They're often perhaps prone to dry skin as well as having all their allergies. So on that basis, You know, as a Westie owner, if we know they're susceptible to skin problems, what can we do? What should I do as a Westie owner to try and help prevent the development of problems with allergy, knowing that these dogs have lots and lots of different faults with their skin?
Sure. Well, I think as a routine, if I had a Westie, I would be making sure that the diet that it was on was very high in terms of the essential fatty acid content. Essential fatty acids, particularly the omega-3, but also the omega-6 essential fatty acids, are really important in maintaining that skin barrier function. And there's really good evidence with trials that show that EFA supplementation definitely does normalize an abnormal skin barrier in studies that have been done. So using a diet that is high in EFA content would be something I would recommend.
So Jan, sorry, so when you say EFAs, what do you mean fish oil, corn oil, even primrose oil?
Fish oils, evening primrose oil, blackcurrant seed oil. There are a number of EFAs that fit into the omega-6 and the omega-3 groups, which are the ones that are important in skin barrier function. And you can buy capsules to supplement a commercial diet. But there are actually a number of commercial diets that have been formulated with the dog that has skin problems in mind. And these are not hypoallergenic diets, which I put in inverted commas, that we would use for ruling out a food allergy. These are supportive diets that are formulated with large amounts of omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids in them, as well as other vitamins and minerals that can be helpful in maintaining skin barrier function.
And so, Jan, one of the questions that I commonly get asked by clients, and I'm sure you do, so worried pet owners, is, well, if my dog's got a problem with yeast, because that's what Malassezia is, it's a yeast infection on the skin, can they have a diet that's got yeast in? And how would you answer that?
Okay. I get that question a lot as well. And you just need to explain that the yeast on the skin, Malassezia, is not like brewer's yeast or the yeast that's in bread. It's a yeast like Candida yeast, which can cause infections in people. And actually, there's very similar yeast in humans that causes seborrheic dermatitis with dandruff and skin fold issues. So you need to explain that it's a different type of yeast from a dietary yeast or a baking yeast. And nothing that you put in the diet is causing your dog to have extra yeast on its skin. It is a function of there being abnormalities in your dog's skin that are allowing or creating an environment that is conducive to the growth of the yeast organism on the skin surface, often at sites where it shouldn't normally be, because the small numbers of yeast organisms are quite normal, particularly in healthy ears, in small numbers, and around the nose and mouth and around the perineal area. But what we find in these allergic Westies particularly is that you get overgrowth of these yeast organisms in the armpits and in the groin and often between the toes as well.
Yeah, I mean, grief, it sounds like there's a minefield of things. But, I guess if I'm trying to bring this all together into what you guys are talking about, there's something can be upsetting the skin in essence, and then you get this, the kind of normal levels of bacteria and things on the skin are all getting upset, and then that's causing this sort of overreaction. But you're saying that owners can manage that by using a combination of different things to try and to help their pets from having that reaction. I mean, could another idea as well, which will often get asked to us by owners, is, as an owner, could we just put them on a raw food? And would that potentially sort that out? Is all these issues caused by, the dry diets and the pre-formulated diets and things?
I'll answer that one in a moment, because I'm just going to backtrack slightly and say that as well as using a diet that's got extra or high levels of essential fatty acids, another thing that I would recommend for any Westie owner to do regularly would be to bathe the dog on a regular basis with a shampoo that has a medicated property, so that it is you're trying to normalize the surface concentration of bacteria and yeast and take it back to a more normal, diverse population instead of it being predominated by, the things that cause the inflammation and the problems. So a regular medicated shampoo bath, I think, is something that you can do as a preventative. And also, you know, if you've got a dog that's allergic to environmental allergens, it will also help by washing off the surface allergens, because, you know, they get through the damaged skin surface. So the combination of shampooing and increased dietary essential fatty acids are two really good things you can do. And now I'm not skirting the question, but to come back to the raw diet, I think it's become terribly fashionable, and I'm not really sure why, because if you try and look at evidence-based information that is available, I actually found a piece of evidence that suggested that actually cooked meats were less allergenic, in other words, less likely to trigger an allergic reaction in a susceptible animal than raw protein molecules. So I can't see a good reason from any evidence base to feed a raw diet in the hope that it might prevent your dog developing allergy, and it certainly won't have the increased essential fatty acids and other things added to it that could support a dog with an allergic skin disease. And if you actually look at veterinary bodies around the world, not just in the UK, but Europe, North America, Canada, none of those veterinary bodies recommend the administration of raw food diets, because there are real risks associated with that diet in terms of both health of your animal and public health, because a lot of these diets have been shown to be contaminated by food poisoning organisms. And so I personally don't see any evidential base for an advantage of using a raw food diet over a properly formulated commercial diet, particularly one that is a skin support diet with extra things added to it.
I think what's interesting as well, there's quite a lot now published in the literature looking at the use of these oil supplements to help the skin. And there's been some electron microscopy studies looking at the skin in really great detail, showing you can improve the function, the barrier function of the skin by using essential fatty acids, which, of course, you're not going to get in a diet that's raw meat, are you? You're just going to get protein.
No, absolutely.
This podcast is brought to you by Vetrus, specialists in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy. Vetrus bring you products such as Otodine and CLX wipes, market-leading products in the management of skin and ear cases.
But you guys have talked about the other things that we can use, and obviously you mentioned shampooing there, Janet.
Yeah.
And like, as an owner, how, when there are so many products on the internet and at the vets and what not to choose from, like, how do you go about even beginning to sort of select the right product that might work for your pet?
I know there's an awful lot of shampoos out there, and companies that make shampoos and other products for dogs are very well aware of owner concerns and possible marketing niches, and there are new things popping up all the time. I always try and be evidence-based, and so I would always suggest that owners talk to vets, and lots of practices have vet nurses who have particular interest in dermatology, and they're a good source of advice for, you know, shampoos that are going to be beneficial for the particular problem in that particular dog.
So if we're looking at, you know, if I'm picking up a bottle of shampoo or I'm searching on the internet, what sort of antiseptics would you consider would be useful? So what actives should I be looking for in a bottle of shampoo, Jan, to give it an antibacterial or an anti-yeast activity?
Okay, well, good antibacterial and anti-yeast activity has been shown for chlorhexidine, and chlorhexidine is in an awful lot of veterinary shampoos. There is also evidence for chlorozylenol, which is in two or three shampoos. If you've got definite yeast problems, there are shampoos that combine other ingredients that are helpful against the yeast. So antifungal elements like the miconazoles and other azoles. There are shampoos that incorporate acids like lactic acid or acetic acid, and they are very effective against yeast organisms. So that gives you some of the ingredients where there is an evidence base for their use.
And we also talked a little bit earlier on about the fact that these dogs have got a barrier function problem. So what about things like moisturisers? Moisturising perhaps mousses or sprays, would you use those with an antiseptic shampoo?
Yeah, I think they can be helpful. And I think I have some clients where they use both an antiseptic shampoo and then a soothing moisturising shampoo afterwards. There are some moisturising sprays available. Some of my favourites have gone off the market, but there are sprays available. I do find that with sprays and mousses, I do have clients complaining that it makes the hair coat texture and feel sticky, and so I do get reluctance with uptake of some of the mousses. I mean, as well as the humidifiers and the moisturizers, there's good evidence that using a chlorhexidine spray or mousse intermittently is just as good as frequent bathing and a lot easier for clients to do, and you get more residual effect, because when you use a shampoo you wash it off, and so it's worked for whilst it was on the animal and then you've rinsed it off. And there are some that have ingredients that mean there's a bit more persistence of action, but some of the sprays and mousses that contain chlorhexidine will give you a much more prolonged, you know, medicated effect. So those can be used as well.
So you could perhaps use a moisturising shampoo, a soothing shampoo, and then in between times you could perhaps use a mousse or a spray, an antiseptic mousse or a spray.
Absolutely.
Because you know it's going to give that prolonged mode of action, couldn't you? Which is an easy way of doing it.
And I think, you know, there's no one recipe or routine that works for every dog. So I often sort of make suggestions to owners and let them come back to me with what works best for them.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating listening to you two kind of muse over this. Two real leading dermatologists, and it's wonderful. It's obviously a huge subject for us to try and cover. Now, I just want to kind of bring us into land by thinking about if I'm an owner now, then I have a Westie and I've downloaded all this information. But, you know, kind of at what point, you've mentioned like discoloration of the feet from licking. You know, you've talked about a greasy coat. And I guess, you know, ear presentations as well can be just as much a sign. So perhaps some sort of flashcards to have in people's mind of when should they actually think about taking their Westie to the vet?
You've summarised that beautifully. And often ear problems can be the first presenting sign. So head shaking, rubbing, redness of the ear flaps, scratching at the ears, more wax coming from the ears than they would expect. Don't wait for it to get bad. You need to be going to the vet early rather than late. And I would say that, as you know, the first episode, of ear trouble or you know, a sore foot or a rash, okay, it might be a one-off, but as soon as it happens a second time, that should be a warning flag that this could well be the early signs of an allergic Westie. And at that point, I think it would be appropriate to start pushing for some further investigations, because if you know exactly what the driving factors are, then you can address those. You can address the underlying problem properly, whether it be a food allergy or more commonly an environmental allergy. But if you know what it is and you diagnose it accurately, then you've got the possibility of an allergy vaccine to retrain the immune system. And in my experience, starting an allergy vaccine early when it's a young dog and it hasn't had the disease very long, you stand a very, very good chance of re-educating that animal's immune system to learn to behave in a tolerant way. And you're addressing the root cause of the problem, and hopefully then we'll be avoiding future flares and side effects. And if they need a little bit of medication alongside a vaccine, it should be far less than treating just the symptoms without addressing the underlying problem.
Brilliant. Thanks, Janet. So yeah, absolutely. So the first sort of signs that you get, the owners are going to be going to the vets. But let's say things have rumbled on a little bit. Perhaps the vets tried some different things, or perhaps they feel like they're not doing some of the things that we've been talking about on this podcast. So at what point or at any point should an owner perhaps push for the vet to seek the advice of a specialist?
I think from the second presentation onwards, I think that yeah, if you've got a Westie and it's had two episodes of ear disease or one episode of ear disease and one episode of spots, you're likely to have an allergic Westie. And I would want to get the involvement of a specialist or someone with a special interest in dermatology early on. The success rate of vaccines and the success in managing these dogs is far better if you have early involvement of a dermatologist. And that's been published by more than one study.
And I think what we should say about that, and of course, Jan, both you and I are hugely conflicted here because we're both specialists, of course. But I mean, I think what we should say is that specialists probably have got further training, but they've had more practice. And I think all of this is about practice, that the more practice you get, the luckier you get with these things. So yeah. I think, you know, speaking to a specialist, even if your vet just gets advice, you know, that I think is really, really useful. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, the experience of handling cases over a number of years is invaluable. We're lucky. We've got some really good drugs available now that are licensed for use in itchy dogs and allergic dogs. And it's very easy for primary practice vets to use these. My worry is that in time, the animals that have initially responded well to symptomatic treatment may not do so well. And I see plenty of dogs that have had skin disease for 4, 5, 6, 7 years. They initially responded well to logical symptomatic treatment, but now they've got problems again. They're non-responsive to treatment, and those are really difficult cases to manage sometimes. They often don't respond to vaccines as well if you start them when they're older. And if they've been through a whole range of symptomatic treatments before, they are going to be more of a challenge to get under control. So even if your dog responds beautifully to the injection of Locovetmab or Cytopoint or to Ocrelizumab tablets, I would still be encouraging people to look for a definitive diagnosis and a solution to actually address the underlying allergic tendency.
Fantastic. Well, I know you and I could perhaps chew the fat here all day, but as we are coming to the end of the podcast, I suppose I should just say, well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We've not seen each other for ages because of COVID, so I really look forward to catching up over something white and sparkling at some stage. And thank you again for taking the time out of your day. I know how busy you are to come and chat to us about West Highland White skin disease. So thank you, Jan. It's been an absolute joy and pleasure. I'm sure John would say the same.
My pleasure too. Thank you very much, Sue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you very much. It's been wonderful dropping in on two dermatologists chewing the fat over Westie skin disease. And yeah, thank you so much on behalf of Skinflint. Well, wasn't that a really fascinating conversation with Janet? And thank you for bringing your one of your best mates on, one of your besties, Sue, because that was really interesting.
Yeah, Janet's fantastic, and she's really great to chat to. She's very relaxed but hugely knowledgeable, which is just what we want really for skinflints, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And Paul, did you enjoy that conversation? Did you have any sort of thoughts or in-depth questions or feelings about what we were talking about?
No, I thought that was a fantastic conversation. I mean, Janet's brilliant, as you've just said. She spoke at our virtual veterinary conference last March. It's extremely well received. So it's always brilliant to hear from Janet. I must say, towards the end of the conversation, although I know mooses is correct grammatically, I just have this slight sort of cognitive dissonance happening. And in my head, it feels like the plural of moose should be meese.
Let's just play it safe and go with foams.
Yes.
Well, no, thanks for that fascinating insight. And I mean, I mentioned, I always have to ask Sue, our leading dermatologist, a question just that, you know, maybe doesn't come up in everyday conversation. So I'm going to try something a bit different this week. I mentioned Tony Robinson before, owns a Westie, quite famous. May know him from Time Team or Blackadder. So I was sort of wondering, Sue, which would be your programme of choice, Time Team or Blackadder?
Well, John, I was suspecting another devious and cunning plan from you. I mean, as cunning as a fox, which should give you a clue that obviously I'm a huge fan of Blackadder. So it would have to be Blackadder with all the fabulous people that are involved with that. I like Time Team, but Blackadder comes out there top every time. In actual fact, my daughter, who is, well, now in her 20s, when she was at school, they watched Blackadder as part of their history talk. So that just shows you the quality of the production that's involved with that. So, yeah, Blackadder for me every single time.
I think we did the same thing at school. Yeah, when I was at school, I think it was the over-the-top bit. Blackadder 4, I think it was, wasn't it? So how about you, Paul?
Likewise, massive fan of Blackadder. And I think, yeah, that the ending to Blackadder Goes Forth is brilliant and poignant in equal measure. And I did have a little bit of a slightly funny story about this. We were talking the other day about Hugh Laurie, and I was trying to explain to my partner who Hugh Laurie was, and obviously was in Blackadder. He was the highest paid actor in the world on House. And eventually she said, "Oh, I know the one. He was the dad in Stuart Little." I thought that was brilliant. That's Hugh Laurie's claim to fame there.
Absolutely. Yeah, clearly his best role. Well, guys, thank you so much. As ever, it's great to chat with you guys. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you next time on Skinflint. So thank you for listening, everyone, and farewell.
The Skinflints podcast, brought to you by Vetrus, the specialists in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy, in association with elearning.vet.